ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For more than 6 months now, the Israeli invasion of Gaza has dominated the news. You would have heard IDF spokespeople defending or explaining the Israeli position. But how much do you know about the Israeli military, its history, and the very unique role it plays in Israeli society? That's our focus this week on Rear Vision. Hello, I'm Jen Leake. Military service is compulsory for most Jewish men and women, and it's been that way since Israel was established. But the IDF is more than an army. The institution played a central role in helping to shape Israel's national identity.
The army was the most important social institution in early Israel, and it stayed that. It stayed as the most important social institution in Israel.
The IDF is referred by everyone as the people's army. It's not like in other countries where the military is kind of a caste or a separate institution. In Israel, you will not find a home that doesn't have family members serving in the military.
The Israeli Defense Force has a different structure to most militaries. Reservists make up the bulk of the force. Young Israelis do their compulsory service, 2 years for women, three for men, but then they get assigned to a reserve unit and will continue to train with that cohort for years after and can be called up for active service. Etan Shamir is a professor at the Bar Ilan University in Israel.
Once you finish conscription, you're assigned to your reserve unit, and those reserve units, actually, they create the majority of the strength of the IDF ground forces. This has like really important implications because not only people do conscription, once they finish conscription, it doesn't mean that they finish their business of the army. They are constantly called into the army, and they're constantly involved, and they're constantly, so this is constantly in touch with the army. I would say the interaction between people in Israel and the military is a non-stop interaction. It's not something that you leave behind.
The reservists have regular jobs, teaching, tech, small business, healthcare. So it can be really disruptive to the economy when large numbers are called up. Since the operation in Gaza began, the IDF has been releasing units after 2 or 3 months so they can return to civilian life.
The reserve is something that is very difficult to maintain. Also, once you rely on reserve, it means that when you recruit a big part of your society, like in the 7th of October, you cannot keep them for too long. They are the one who keeps the economy going. There was an impression in Israel by some of the professionals that because we are in an era of the war on terrorism and because Israel is no longer fighting war on its borders with state-to-state armies that require huge forces, that we can give up a lot of the reserve. And they were trained less, and some of them were also, some units were disbanded. Now everything has turned around. Because following the 7th of October, Israel realized that reserves are needed.
Not everyone who lives in Israel has to serve in the IDF. The two main groups that are exempt, Israeli Arabs and ultra-Orthodox Jews. But more on that later. The importance of the IDF as a foundational institution cannot be underestimated. Israel had an army before it had a cohesive population. Reuven Gal is a former chief psychologist for the IDF.
The IDF was born in the midst of a war. This is the War of Independence.
In 1947, at the end of British-controlled Palestine, the UN announced its partition plan, splitting the territory into separate Jewish and Arab states.
The Jewish people or the Israeli pre-state entity accepted that UN decision. The Palestinians or the Arab parties did not accept it. And the next morning, literally the next morning, a war broke out.
At this stage, there was no official state of Israel and no official army. Instead, the forces were made up of several Zionist paramilitary organizations like the Haganah that had been operating in the region for decades, as well as smaller splinter groups which had carried out terrorist attacks against Palestinian Arabs during British rule. All of these groups came together to fight the Arab states. After around a year and a half of fighting, with a lot of casualties on both sides, in May 1948, Ben-Gurion, who would become the country's first prime minister, announced the State of Israel.
On the same day, or the next morning, it was announced that all these paramilitary groups that existed before that will unite together and become the Israel Defense Forces, namely IDF.
Reuven says the fact the IDF was created during a war is really significant.
When the military is born in the middle of a war, it affects its genes, so to speak. It's DNA. It's a fighting military, and it is like this to these days. It's not a military for parades. In fact, if you look at Israeli IDF soldiers going on parades, on official ceremonies, it's almost a joke. They don't good at, ceremonial things. This is a fighting military, and it all started by the fact that it was born in the middle of that war.
And the idea of having a large reserve army was there right from the start.
That was another part of Ben-Gurion's vision. He said, in a small country like ours, we cannot afford a standing army big enough to defend our borders. Hence, we will have to count on reserve corps. Mm-hmm. And the reserve corps, in fact, is much bigger than the standing army. But in time of wars, these reserves units become regular military. And in order to achieve that, they need to go through training, periodical training, and be always on alert and on and on and on.
The vision for the IDF was always more than just defence. It was established as a nation-building institution. From 1948 onwards, large numbers of Jewish people started arriving in Israel from a wide variety of countries. There were survivors of the Holocaust from Eastern Europe, but also Jews from Egypt, Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco, all bringing different languages and cultures.
Israel in 1948, May 1948, was a just born state with a total population of, listen to this, 600,000 people, Jewish people. We are now about 10 million. And so it was a very tiny little population. But at the same time, there were hundreds of ships and boats coming from Europe with survivors of the Holocaust, and not only from Europe, from Muslim countries as well, all over the world. And it was a huge flow of immigration into Israel. Ben-Gurion foresaw the military as being a vehicle or a platform of socialization for all these newcomers into Israel. They were not born and raised here. They are not part of this culture. They are nothing of that. We need one. He called it a melting pot, which will make them one people. And that melting pot in Ben-Gurion's vision was the IDF. And in order to achieve that, he said everybody will serve in the IDF, men and women. Everyone at the age of 18 will serve in the military.
The IDF had military missions. It also had social and cultural missions, like teaching newcomers Hebrew.
It became a matter of ideology, of nationality, of cultural identity. How do you define a nation? You define it by its language, by its culture, by its norms, by its behaviors, by its ceremonies. Much of that was conducted within the military. The military, for example, used many soldiers, mostly female soldiers, as teachers and sent them to cities, towns, villages and so on, to serve as teachers in the schools because there were not enough teachers.
Haim Brishith's parents arrived in Israel from a refugee camp in Rome where he was born. And originally from Poland, they spoke Yiddish.
My parents came from Auschwitz, or both survived Auschwitz, and Yiddish was their first language. And one of my memories as a very young child is going to see the production of Hamlet in Yiddish, would we believe it, in a place in Jaffa, and it was illegal to do that. I never knew what Hamlet ends like because the police has raided the cinema where this was shown, and we all ran out.
What was your sense of how, as you got older, of how your parents felt about aspects of how Israel was getting set up, so to speak?
Well, I didn't know this, but when we came in 1948 during the first weeks of the war on a boat from a refugee camp in Rome, and I was a two-year-old baby, my father refused to fight. He said that after 6 years of what he has undergone as a Jew in Europe under the Nazis in Poland, he refuses to kill, he refuses to fight, he refuses to harm people, he will not carry a rifle. And he was one of the first, I don't know, he may have been the first, but he was one of the first and very few people who refused to fight after the war. He wasn't typical. I didn't know the story until I was in my 20s, because later on he was ashamed of his position. And, you know, he changed. He did not become a supporter of military action, but he was ashamed that he actually refused to fight. When I was 18 and had to join the army, I didn't want to do it. But as opposed to my father, that was 33 when he arrived to Israel, I was 18 and I wasn't courageous enough. And I didn't know anyone that was refusing to serve in the army. This started a bit later. And I didn't have the moral and personal courage to say, bugger you guys, I am not joining this army. So I did join the army and I served as an officer. Thankfully, I never hurt anyone, but it could have been otherwise. I was not typical to begin with, so I'm not claiming any representation of people in Israel or young men of my age at the time.
From a military perspective, the IDF started to transition into a smaller force in the 1950s, suitable for a period of peace, and many of the veterans of the 1948 war returned to their regular lives.
We realized that it lost a little bit of its sharp edges, and at the same time, what didn't cease to happen were all these attacks from over the borders, not full-scale wars, but all kinds of terrorist attacks and so on. So there was a need to re-establish this fighting spirit of the IDF that was shown during the war, was lost a little bit after the war. The way to do that was not by newcomers, and on the opposite, it was mainly comprised of kibbutzniks, Israeli-born, well-educated, very dedicated, very patriotic.
This major reorganization of the IDF was led by Chief of Staff of the Army, Moshe Dayan, who was appointed in 1953. Under his leadership, the IDF focused on training Air Force, Commando and Armor battalions. The military also improved its hardware through negotiating large weapons contracts with France. It was a combat-ready and focused force.
After weeks of stalemate, the Suez crisis burst dramatically into the news again, for Israel has invaded Egypt. Britain and France have declared the canal in danger, and British and French troops are on the move.
The IDF successfully joined forces with Britain and France in 1956 to attack Egypt after the Suez crisis and tensions over the Sinai Peninsula. But it was in 1967, the Six-Day War, where the IDF had its most impressive and decisive victory.
Against all the fears and doubts and threats that we felt, I say we because I was fighting in that war, the IDF showed that within 6 days, it managed to combat three big militaries, Jordanian, Syrian, and Egyptian, conquer much of their territories and come out victorious in just 6 days. This can happen only with a well-trained, highly motivated, and highly spirited military. And this was the idea for the 60s.
At the time, Reuven was 25. Having finished his initial military service, he was in a reserve unit and also studying at university.
So I lived in Jerusalem. On the morning of June 6, 1967, the war broke out and the Jordanian military pushed into the Israeli territory just south of Jerusalem. I was in a reconnaissance unit, a military reservist kind of infantry, but a reconnaissance unit. That is, we were on vehicles, jeeps and half trucks and so on. And we were deployed immediately to go into that place where the Jordanian attacked and to block, to stop that attack, which we did. And it was quite a bitter battle. I lost four of my soldiers in that battle. That area where I fought, where this battlefield was literally like 2 kilometers away from my home. There was a sense, not only for me, but for all my comrades, all my mates, that we were defending our home, literally.
By the end, Israel massively expanded its territory, seizing the Golan Heights, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank and the Sinai Peninsula. Hundreds and thousands of Palestinians and Syrians fled or were expelled. Just a few years after the astonishing success of the Six-Day War, in 1973, Israel was taken by surprise in another infamous October attack, the Yom Kippur War. And it was significant for a number of reasons. In the aftermath, a reserve captain whose warnings about a potential Egyptian attack were not taken seriously by his superiors began a one-man protest, demanding the Prime Minister and Defence Minister resign. It turned into a mass movement with other reservists joining in, and it did lead to the fall of the government. 1973 was also the last war Israel's very existence was at stake, and the last time the IDF fought against traditional armies. You must have reflected on, if you think about the enemy you were fighting in the Six-Day War and then compare it to your children and then your grandchildren, you know, the nature of the enemy, the nature of the service has changed a lot.
Totally different in many aspects. First of all, the sense of military service in Israel during the 50s, 60s, 70s, up to the early 1980s, and I'll explain why I use that point of time, the sense was of totally just war, not only just wars, but wars about the mere existence of the state of Israel. So all the wars until 1982 were wars for survival, were wars of sheer existence. A second difference is the fact that I in the Six-Day War, or the IDF in all the other wars until 1982, fought against enemies that were states. Jordan, which I fought against in Jerusalem, Syria in the north, Egypt in the south, they were all states, and the militaries were ordinary militaries. These were conventional wars. We were fighting tanks against tanks, infantry battalions against infantry soldiers, and on and on and on. These are not the wars that we have in the last few decades, because we are not fighting states. We are fighting guerrillas. We are fighting terrorist groups.
Mounted a blitzkrieg whose objective was destruction of PLO bases in southern Lebanon.
Reuven mentioned the 1982 Lebanon War, which first started as an attempt to protect settlements near the border with Lebanon that were being attacked.
And the 1982 war was the first one in Israel's history that people sensed that was not a mandatory war or a just war. The Fatah, as they were called at that time, in the north, along our northern borders, people in the northern kibbutz suffered daily bombardments by those Fatah terrorists. And so the war started as an attempt to remove those guerrillas away from the border. But soon enough, after 2 weeks of fighting, the war started to stretch further on, and at some point it reached the city of Beirut. And that's when people in Israel realized that this is not anymore a war about our existence or survival, but it's a political effort by then Prime Minister Menachem Begin and then Minister of Defense Ariel Sharon. And people started to demonstrate. For example, on one Saturday evening, I remember it because I was there, there were 400,000 people protesting in Tel Aviv center, and they were protesting against the war. Get us out of Lebanon. Now, the interesting thing was that a huge percentage of these 400,000 people gathering in Tel Aviv were reserve soldiers who just came home for the Sabbath, for the Saturday. They put on their civilian clothes and they went out for the demonstration. And when the demonstration ended, they went back home, put on their uniforms, and started riding all the way up north to join their units again. The schizophrenic situation that Israel found itself in 1982. And for the first time, we realized that we are enforced to participate in wars that are not necessarily fully just wars.
Later in the 1980s, the First Intifada marked another shift in the experience of serving in the IDF and the type of enemy they were facing. It was a series of Palestinian uprisings against Israel, mass demonstrations led by women, labour strikes, and children throwing stones at Israeli tanks. It required a very different response, and one that the IDF wasn't really trained for.
The First Intifada, those acts were mostly throwing rocks and stones and sometimes stabbing with knives, things like that. When you have, and mostly youth doing that, sometimes kids doing that. And when you have to fight against such warfare, quote unquote, what do? You shoot them? What do? Get some of your first class air fighters, airplanes, and throw bombs on them? How do you fight kids who are throwing rocks and stones? It put the IDF into an almost impossible situation. This is when the IDF units and IDF soldiers started to be involved in what we, the Israeli academics in the social, psychological, political science areas, we call it constabulary missions. Now it was soldiers against citizens, sometimes kids, and it was not fighting less like soldiers, it was more like constabulary, like policing. It became even more policing when they started to put all those checkpoints. These were soldiers in that checkpoints. And what do you do in the checkpoint? You do like policing. You check the IDs. This is something that it's not exactly military. It's a mix and a very bad mix that affects the military very badly.
A soldier who's doing their service, there isn't an active war, but they're doing that policing role. There would be a range of experiences, but coming face to face with reactions from a population, you know, the feeling you can feel them detesting you. I mean, I imagine that puts a different pressure, a low grade pressure, but could have a profound impact on someone.
It does. It depends a lot on the background of that soldiers. We have now in the IDF many soldiers who wear yarmulkes. Yeah, these are religious soldiers, many of whom live, their homes are within those settlements in the West Bank. And they have a very clear right-wing nationalistic ideology. And they feel that as many as dead Arabs is better. So these soldiers, in a way, in some paradoxical way, they are more immune against these traumatic impact compared to another soldier in the same unit who comes from a left-wing home. Actually, I'm talking about my grandkids now, I guess, who was raised and educated and brought up on more liberal and left-wing thoughts. And when he sees those 100,000 refugees in the Gaza, and he has to shoot into them or fight, destroy their homes and so on. It creates such a moral, conscientious conflict that this by itself is a foundation for a post-traumatic sensation.
Eyal Meroz lives in Australia but served in the IDF in the 1980s. He lived in a kibbutzim, a cohort that have traditionally opposed the expansion of Jewish settlements in the West Bank.
When the questions around morality came to the fore, because on kibbutzim, most people living on kibbutzim are on the left side of the political map, and so obviously a lot of rejection of the settlement movement in the West Bank and so on. But the idea was that we were fed with was, if left-wing or people that are more morally aligned with left-wing beliefs are not going to go and serve in the army, refuse to serve in the army, whether in the regular army or later in the reserve service, then the ones that are going to do that are on the political right, and therefore that's a recipe for even worse human rights violations. So that's why we should, swallow the pill and still do that, because if we are there, then the situation would be not as bad as it could be. So I remember that as a big incentive on the kibbutzim calling, yes, we should serve and try to avoid worse off situations.
And as more IDF soldiers return home from Gaza, there's growing anger around the continued exemption of ultra-Orthodox Jews. It's a section of society that has never had to serve. In 1948, it was a group of 400 students who didn't have to do military service so they could study and preserve sacred Jewish knowledge after the horror of the Holocaust. But today, they make up almost 14% of the population.
They do not serve, and that's a big issue nowadays in Israel, and creates a lot of resentment among the non-religious parties and among people like me who do serve. Mm. I mean, in my case, just to run fast forward from my time of service in 1960s to the present time, right now I have 5 grandchildren who are serving in the military at this very moment.
It's too early to tell how the IDF will change as a result of the war in Gaza. But just like past conflicts, it will have an impact on the institution and those who serve in it.
During the first days after October 7th, there was an amazement, an astonishment. People could not believe that the IDF was so helpless, so passive, so inactive and so on. They still, to this day, cannot understand, cannot believe. Israel is under severe trauma. Part of that was expressed by the way that the IDF soldiers went into the Gaza. This is something you cannot ignore, you cannot deny. There was a sense of revenge. I mean, there was a very strong sense of, they did to us something so unbelievable, so unhuman, that they deserve anything. We'll destroy them, we'll kill them, and so on. Now, the IDF as a military didn't allow that openly. But at the same time, the soldiers, they have their own feelings, their own emotions. And there were more bursts of vengeance, of aggression, and so on, that could not be resisted because of what happened on the 7th.
Reuven Gal is a senior research fellow at the Samuel Nieman Institute for National Policy. Etan Shamir is a professor at the Bar-Ilan University. Eyal Meroz is a senior lecturer in peace and conflict studies at the University of Sydney. And Haim Breshith is author of An Army Like No Other. I'm Jen Leake. You've been listening to Rear Vision.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.